Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer and WNYC, and we invite you to check out our new online census project, 10 Questions That Count. See census videos, add your household's portrait to our 10 questions photo gallery, nominate an 11th question. What one additional question would you ask all Americans? And new as of today, take our first 2010 census quiz. Go to WNYC.org and click on Brian Lehrer Show for our 10 Questions That Count census project website. Well, over the past week, as you have almost no doubt heard, what might have been a behind-the-scenes disagreement between Israel and the United States over settlements has blown up into a very public firestorm. Ground was broken for settlement growth that the U.S. opposes in Jerusalem while Vice President Biden was there. The U.S. released word of a 45-minute tense conversation between the Israeli Prime Minister and Secretary of State Clinton. By yesterday, Palestinians were holding the biggest street protests in years, with some calling for a third intifada. Here is White House advisor David Axelrod, a minute's worth of what he said on ABC This Week on Sunday, tough language.
What happened there was an affront, it was an insult, but that's not the most important thing. What it did was it made more difficult a very difficult process. We've just gotten proximity, so-called proximity talks going between the Palestinians and the Israelis, and this seemed calculated to undermine that, and that was distressing to everyone who is promoting the idea of peace and security in the region. Israel is a strong and special ally. The bonds run deep, but for just that very reason, this was not the right way to behave. That was expressed by the Secretary of State as well as the Vice President. I'm not going to discuss what diplomatic talks we've had underneath that, but I think the Israelis understand clearly why we were upset and what we want moving forward.
White House advisor David Axelrod, a minute's worth of what he said on ABC This Week on Sunday. So is there a way out? Is there a way forward? David Makovsky is a senior fellow at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy and director of their project on the Middle East peace process. He's also co-author of Myths, Illusions, and Peace, Finding a New Direction for America in the Middle East. David, welcome back to WNYC.
I always love being on your show, Brian.
Thank you. Do you agree with Axelrod that Netanyahu did this purposely to undermine the new peace process?
Well, I don't know if he said he purposely did it, but the net effect
he
was...
He said calculated to undermine.
Well, I don't think he personally blames him. He might blame people lower down the chain.
Uh-huh.
But I think it seems to me a perfect storm. I don't think Netanyahu sought to sabotage the vice president's mission. I mean, just 2 days before the vice president landed, Netanyahu spoke to the mayor of Jerusalem. There was a different issue going on, and he basically said, shut it down. You know, we don't want anything that will hurt the vice president's visit.
So do you think someone further down the chain did it?
Yes. I don't know if he did it deliberately, but I think what happened was that he did either not connect the dots lower down, the interior minister, or that there was someone indifferent to it. But it was a step on a long process of a planning board to set up this neighborhood in East Jerusalem, where a neighborhood already exists. The Israelis don't like the word settlements when it comes to Jerusalem. They see it as a seamless area, but it's an area under contention. Let's be clear, and that's
right.
Why there's a negotiation.
Part of the area that they took in the 1967. What about the Obama administration going so public with the idea that this is an affront? Why not tell that to the Israelis privately so as not to back Netanyahu into a corner just when they want him to move toward the center?
Exactly. That's what I think Vice President Biden tried to do on Thursday. That's why I thought the crisis had subsided somewhat. Netanyahu apologized to Biden, and Biden said, publicly denounced the move, but, gave a very gracious speech that was in many ways pitch perfect, I would say, in terms of what, he was sent over there for, which was a fence mending mission, and to demonstrate the close connections between the two countries. He spoke about Iran. He spoke about a wider array of issues. It was the most successful visit in that regard. But what happened was, instead of the issue subsiding on a Thursday, on a Friday it was revived. From what we understand, the president personally was upset that he felt that there was a commitment by Netanyahu to create a mechanism so neither the prime minister is blindsided. Again, no one blames him that he's suicidal, that he wants any form of a confrontation with the vice president, but that there would be a mechanism in place so that the prime minister gets control of his own government in a way that these incidents don't happen. And then this happened a second time. And that's what I think drove the president to distraction. But the mistake, in my view, was at the State Department, where it's one thing to say, we had a 43-minute conversation and we told Netanyahu how we felt, but then you said, well, this raises questions about their commitment to the relationship itself. And that really was what tipped this whole thing over the edge into a whole new level, because it sounded like U.S.-Israel relations were in the balance when the whole idea of sending Biden there was to say that the bond is very deep and enduring, the contours are broad, we may have differences from time to time, but it doesn't affect the fundamentals.
So whose language was that at the State Department? Was it Secretary Clinton herself?
P.J. Crowley, the State Department spokesman, which you assume was done, something so sensitive was done, with the authorization. Where I think we're past the peak of this crisis was yesterday afternoon when Hillary Clinton did a stakeout and said, the fundamentals are sound. We have an issue here. We're going to solve it. But, basically she reaffirmed everything Biden did. And I think that de-escalates this whole issue. It hasn't solved it yet. But I think both sides would like to de-escalate and to find a way, to get to the table, which is the whole idea. Instead of us talking about the symptoms of these issues, try to solve them. And that's what negotiations are for. That's what the United States is trying to produce. Israel has said it wants direct talks. It's actually the Palestinians who haven't wanted the direct talks, so they agreed on these proximity talks, which hopefully will be transitional to direct talks. Proximity talks just means that George Mitchell gets in a car in Jerusalem and travels 15 minutes to Ramallah and comes back and does it that way. And that's not ideal 21 years or 19 years after the Madrid Peace Conference where they launched face-to-face talks. But it's better than nothing, and so that's where we are.
Well, you hope that the relations, or the tensions, I should say, between the U.S. and Israel will de-escalate, but are you afraid that this incident will spark a third intifada, that phrase that some people are now using?
Well, if we look at the first two intifadas as guides, you would say the first intifada broke out at a time of utter desperation, where there was no negotiations at all. And the second intifada broke off after you kind of went to the mountaintop with the Bill Clinton, the Camp David 2 summit in the summer of 2000. And that was when I think Yasser Arafat gave the word out, we tried negotiations, we didn't get what we want, let's try violence. So we're in neither of those two peaks and valleys. There's now a mechanism for these talks, and so it's not a question of there's no mechanism, and we haven't just come from the summit to try to solve it all and failed. So we're somewhere in the middle, and I think the good news, Brian, is developments on the ground. I know people are so used to being pessimistic about the Middle East, you feel if you tell them any good news, you've ruined their day. But I do think for your listeners, they should know there is some good news out there. You've got now in the West Bank a situation that Salam Fayyad, the Prime Minister of the Palestinian Authority, working with Israel for the most part, although there's been issues, trying to improve security cooperation, and that has meant more order and the streets for the Palestinians in their polls. They used to say less than 10% felt safe in the streets because it was so chaotic with gangs and terror groups. And now the numbers are almost 70%. And there is economic growth of 7% at the time of a worldwide recession. The security cooperation is such that Israel's benefited too, because we had 410 Israelis killed in 2002. I think last year the number of Israelis killed was like 2 or 3. So you do have a situation that that there's developments on the ground, economic developments that are good for the Palestinians, and as the, you know, because Israel's removed checkpoints, as the security situations improve, if security gets better, they don't need all these checkpoints. So they've taken that down, and you have basically what's fascinating, and it, I think could be a new paradigm of Palestinian nationalism, is that Yasser Arafat believed that it's all about entitlement, that if you're occupied, you're not responsible for anything, but you're entitled to everything. And I think Salam Fayyad is trying to create a culture of accountability whereby it's about the institutions you build. He even told George W. Bush, he goes, look how the Israelis built that state. The Zionists, they did it by building institutions from the bottom up. And that's what we have to do as Palestinians to emulate that. And that's a new approach, and that's away from the headlines. You don't read about it as much.
And Tom,
but it's important.
Thomas Friedman, as you probably know, in his New York Times column, wrote about exactly that as well today. And he also framed it in terms of Fayyad on the one side, who wants to build these strong, effective Palestinian government structures, including a police force and an economy, to show Israel that it can govern effectively and set up conditions for a Palestinian state that way. Split, of course, with Hamas, which is aligned with Iran and Hezbollah in a strategy to bait Israel into aggressive actions. But Friedman concludes that Netanyahu is helping Hamas with the settlement construction expansions. How much do you agree?
Well, I think that, you know, Netanyahu, to his credit, is the first Israeli leader who has agreed to a qualified moratorium for 10 months. It might not be a complete freeze, as the administration would have hoped, but it's better than any of his predecessors agreed to, including those more on the more liberal end. But so, that, you know, there's some good signs. My main point, Brian, is we got to get to the table. You want a solution that gives dignity to both sides. And we can't solve all the problems, I think, at once. I think issues like Jerusalem and refugees are narrative issues, and these leaders have not conditioned their public on either side for accommodation and breakthrough. But ironically, on the issue of land, which I know is counterintuitive to your listeners because they feel it's all about land, that's where the differences are actually narrowest. And I think you had a situation that Ehud Olmert, who was Netanyahu's predecessor, he and Abbas were within 4 percentage points of each other on solving the land issue. And I was very delighted that Senator Mitchell said he was going to try to solve the border issue first. And the reason why that's so important, well, for the United States, once there's a border, then the settlement issue becomes moot, right? Because if you're in the border, you're not called a settlement, you're called Israel. If you're outside the border, you're outside the border, and you'll be in the Palestinian state, or you'd be dismantled. So that would be important, and it would be important for the Palestinians, who could say, we got the land that Anwar Sadat got in the 70s in Egypt, 100% of the land. And for the Israelis, the only way they're going to be able to annex the settlers that they want, and people don't know this, listeners don't know this, but 80% of the settlers live in less than 5% of the land, 240 out of 300,000 of them. And but the way to do that is to have what we would call land swaps, and even Yasser Arafat agreed to that, which is if Israel keeps 5%, it yields 5%.
So
and within the line. And that, I think, is very much within reach. And that's why I was so happy that Mitchell said that that's where he wants to put the focus. Now, you have to deal with security arrangements about the land. But I think when people keep talking about settlements and the symptoms, we got to try to find the cure. And the cure is demarcate a border, so everyone gains something big, and we're not just in the same loop of the past. And I think that's a big gain for America, for the Palestinians, and for Israel. Each one would gain big from a border.
So before you go, on this, you know, only 4% difference over what the borders are, supporters of Netanyahu at the moment in this disagreement with the United States are saying the neighborhood of northeast Jerusalem in question here is not even part of what would be returned to the Palestinians. That even, you know, Mahmoud Abbas had supported this part of East Jerusalem going back to Israel in a land swap because it's a very inner part of East Jerusalem that Israel would probably... If that's true, then why would the U.S. make a big deal out of this in particular if it doesn't even expand the land?
That is an excellent point that you just made, and I don't know if I have the exact answer, but because there's such an undifferentiated view of land that's out there, that everything seems to be an obstacle. And, yeah, I've also heard from Palestinians about this area of Ramat Shlomo. They'll be part of Israel in any deal. And that's why I'm so, you know, you can pull your hair out, because you're just saying, you know, the demarcation is clear. Let's move to the end game, cut to the chase, and not have these flashpoint incidents. Again, it should not be an issue, as you suggest, but right now we don't have a differentiated view of the land. You know, we have a very undifferentiated view, which I think is not realistic, but so long as there's no agreement, people will say, well, you're jumping the gun, or it's negotiating in bad faith, or whatever it is. So my view in all this is, you know, let's keep our eye on the ball, our eyes on the prize, and let's get to the negotiations themselves and demarcate this area as sooner rather than later, so we can avoid these flashpoints and have a much more nuanced view of the situation on the ground.
David Makovsky, senior fellow at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, director of their project on the Middle East peace process, and co-author of Myths, Illusions, and Peace: Finding a New Direction for America in the Middle East. Thank you very much.
Delighted to be with you, Brian.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up next, we'll take a St. Patrick's Day census of Irish New York. Irish New Yorkers and anywhere in our listening area, really. If you're Irish, call us up. Tell us where you live, how you live, what you're thinking about on this St. Patrick's Day. 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692.